Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Adam Koch is my name, Ozan Ibrahim and Rodney McCune are my co-hosts. Gents, good to see you again.
Good to be with you.
Yep, good. All good.
Well, all good for you, Rodney, but not necessarily in the global economic order because, well, it's really, really hard to keep up. But the latest at the time of recording is that Trump, President Trump of the United States, has said that he will back down on the tariffs imposed on China. I think there was somewhere in the vicinity of around 250% in the end. It's now sort of not going to be at the levels that he said it initially would be. Rodney, try to make sense of what is happening. We've spoken a lot on this podcast about the on-again, off-again tariffs, but why this sudden back down from Trump?
Because he managed to bring about the greatest potential economic collapse ever, was the mood music. So he obviously was forced to back down, but his ego wouldn't allow him to U-turn. So he's had to say that he's pausing these tariffs, and it's all related to Musk exiting stage. The IMF are now revised US growth down from 3.3 to 2.0. No, it's down, yeah, globally down to 2.8, US down to 1.8. The UK is down to about 1%, which is consistent with the OBR. So, you know, Trump's tariffs and his deal with China has just precipitated a catastrophic vacuum of confidence. And the confidence is based on the uncertainty, or the lack of confidence based on the uncertainty. And therefore, Trump's behavior continues to create more problems. His attack on the Fed and his own appointee is another point of concern, which is depressing markets and so on. And he is just chaos, and he's chaos in charge of the economy. The best assessment so far of his economic performance has been, had he just done nothing, Americans would be much better off. Says it all, really. So yeah, he's U-turned despite his ego, and he's making a mess of things. Unless, of course, you're called Jose or, I don't know, Raj. India and Spain seem to have less exposure to the US markets, as do Saudi Arabia and South Africa. So their growth predictions for this year are not impacted by what's going on with the US. But as for the UK, the EU, Canada, Mexico, China, the US itself, all very negative impacts. So he has U-turned to an extent, I think, but he calls it a pause. Ozan's right in predicting that this would happen. No one seems any the wiser as to what's going to happen over the next few months, which will completely inhibit any economic rebound or effective economic rebound. Is that fair, Ozan? I don't know.
Well, I mean, to put simply, the damage is done. And you can talk all you like about, or they can talk all they like about trying to manage the US out of this. And, you know, economists, I think, are in full agreement, as are investment banks, as is the IMF. I mean, the IMF said it without saying it, that, you know, it doesn't matter how much of a U-turn you make, it doesn't matter how much you step down, the damage is done. There is a significant trust deficit with the US right now. And, you know, all you need to do is look at gold. I mean, gold's flying. The US is losing, the US dollar is losing its value against most of the main currencies or major currencies. You know, there is a confidence deficit, there's a trust deficit. And, you know, there's nothing really you can do from here. It's just about trying to minimize the damage, and you know, flip-flopping on tariffs is not going to go very far in minimizing that damage. What needs to happen is they need to make it very clear about what it is they're going to do on international trade, what it is that they're going to do when it comes to monetary policy, bullying your own appointed Federal Reserve chair is probably not the best way of giving investors and the money markets and the financial markets some certainty about what's going to happen. But yeah, I think it's what's also concerning is, and this is probably not getting a lot of news, but there have been many other non-tariff related type of measures that they've put up against some countries in Asia, and you know, these are also very, very concerning. And I think, you know, what I find quite, I would like to say funny, but at the end of the day, it's very sad, is that they're boasting about doing potentially some sort of trade agreement with India. And JD Vance, before his 3-minute audience with the late Pope, sorry, after his audience with the late Pope, went over to India and sat down with Modi and you know, struck or kind of talked about the details of a potential trade deal. But you know, what's funny about this is you can do trade deals without tanking the world economy. This is not an achievement. This is how it was done before Trump came into power, and this is how it should be done. You don't have to threaten everybody. And use somehow use these sorts of things as negotiating, and I, you know, use that term very, very cautiously. But you know, you don't have to tank the world economy. You don't have to destroy confidence in the world economy in your own country, and you know, you can just go and do trade deals like everyone else has done in the last century. And this is how things should operate. But yeah, look, I think when you look at the politics of it, again, to put simply, I don't think it's yet registering in terms of his approval rating. It seems to be hovering around the 46, 47, 48 mark, depending on which poll you look at. So it hasn't taken a massive dive yet. And a lot of that also is really the right-wing media ecosystem, and somewhat echo chamber that many of his supporters are in, and you know, all of his surrogates in the right wing media running around saying, you know, we've got a this is got a long term strategy behind it. Don't worry, Trump knows what he's doing. Just have confidence. We're going to have some short term pain for long term gain, etc. And many of his supporters have and many kind of others within the US society have actually believed this and think that this is somehow something that they need to go through to come out better at the other end. And that's just absurd to me because you don't have to go through this because you know what? There is no other end. There is no vision. There is no light at the end of the tunnel. There is no grand scheme. It's just utter incompetence and just really, really bad way of managing a country, be it that the most powerful country and economy in the world.
And of course, the economic troubles are hitting not only the country and the rest of the world based on Trump's actions, but some of his inner circle. And Rodney, you alluded to this earlier. Tesla profits, or rather net income in the first quarter, has fallen 71%, forcing the billionaire CEO Elon Musk, of course, one of Trump's loyalists and the head of the Department of Government Efficiency, or one of the leaders of that department, saying that he'll be spending less time on that and more time on his business. What on earth is happening at Tesla?
That's a very good question. They're not as popular as they used to be, that's what I think. And part of it's because everyone who sorry, a large number of people who Tesla once appealed to intensely dislike the brand because of Elon Musk. And he probably does need to get back to trying to detoxify the brand that he toxified himself. But as Ozan said, with the economy, perhaps with Tesla, the damage is already done. It's hard to have huge sympathy for the richest man of the world who went off to share platforms with far right politicians, feign Roman salutes, etc., and enjoy his moment, you know, in the political spotlight, that he now has to go and clean up a financial mess that he seems to have created within his own business empire. So shame about that. The other thing is that these BYD or whatever cars from China are probably just nicer.
Well, I mean, I think for me, it's two things. As Rodney said, I think the level of competition for electric vehicles has significantly increased. You're getting probably better cars now from BYD. I know that the European car manufacturers are beginning to produce pretty good, solid, reliable EVs. Obviously, there's question marks around networks, etc. But I think when you look at just the car, the many of the kind of competitors to Tesla are really catching up. But you know, for me, of course, the other thing is it turns out that many people were buying Teslas because they had an ideological belief in electric vehicles being the future and getting away from fossil fuels, etc. And it turns out that those people don't appreciate the owner of the company in which they've invested their money to buy the car or through their shares. Yeah, they don't appreciate him, as Rodney said, backing far-right candidates and just behaving generally in a very distasteful manner. I mean, you just have to look at the stuff that he posts on X or whatever his platform is called these days. It's just, you know, he's basically telling people to F off. And he's behaving like a child and a very badly behaved child at that. So yeah, it turns out that these people don't appreciate that. And you know, it's a great sign that the you know the free market works. If you don't like the brand, you know, divest from it, or you sell your Tesla, or you don't buy one if you were in the market for an EV. So I think he's in deep trouble. I think it's another sign, if you needed one, that, you know, if you're in business and you want to get involved in politics, you really better know what you're doing. Otherwise, you're going to end up really damaging your brand. I think that's a big lesson for many within the corporate world. You know, it's if you're going to go out there and make statements about political issues, just know what you're doing.
What is it with these billionaires who just want to get into politics? I mean, we've seen Mark Zuckerberg bought a mansion in Washington, which is, you know, more telling of what his aspirations are, of course, on the back of a damaging book that was written by his former global public affairs director, which I had the privilege of reading over the last week or so, where she claims that, you know, Mark was indeed for a long time looking to run for president, and it is something that he wants to do. We've got Elon Musk doing that. Rodney, honestly, I mean, these people who have made billions, who have wealth enough to save several developing countries really and get them out of poverty, what's the play with wanting to sit in the White House?
Nothing less. So one is that sometimes their financial and business success, whether it be by skill or an element of good fortune of being in the right place at the right time in the right sector, it fuels their self-belief in a way that they believe they can conquer everything. And if they've conquered global financial tick to be some, you know, huge wealth sitting on individual, they then want to have the power of other areas that go with it, or they genuinely believe that they're so gifted that they can make incredible changes within a political environment. But it's a concoction of greed, ambition, and ego that bring them to do this. It's very rarely motivated by some, you know, philanthropic outlook on making the world a better place. I think it's that they're the best person for the job. I think that's sadly as far as it goes.
I think it also comes down to kind of relevance deprivation as well. I mean, I think if you're that rich, you're that powerful from a business point of view, etc., you have this desire, I guess, to be relevant all the time. And let's face it, politics is the main game in most countries. And you know, if you're going out as the head of Facebook or Meta or Tesla making some announcement, you're hardly going to get the level of media attention, particularly from the corporate media and others as well, that the president would or a politician would in quite a high profile portfolio. So I think they feel that they've, as Rodney said, conquered everything, and they want to be continuing to be relevant, and they want to be at the center of it all. And it's, you know, politics is show business for ugly people, and you know, it's the main game in town. So.
Yeah, and like most of them interact first of all with politicians, where politicians or political parties approach them for donations. And if you're sitting there saying, "I'm paying money to get this person who I think is less able than me elected, I might as well do it myself." And if I've got my business running without me needing to be hands on, I may wish to go and do that. Although the Elon Musk example, of course, is that while he was at Doge, things didn't go very well, but. That's probably the thought process that sits behind it.
I mean, the question also, well, I was just going to say the question also is, you know, do business people make good politicians? Probably
That's exactly what I was going to ask. I mean, isn't there an argument that the world is run, our capitalist world is now run by businesses and global empires, and is there an argument to be made that politicians who come from a business background and who start to run countries like businesses, which is of course the argument that Trump and his supporters often make. I mean, is that a good thing for democracies and for running of countries, I guess, which Ozan, that's where you're going with, I think.
Well, yeah, and I think good business people can make good politicians. Trump was never a good business person, so I think that, you know, that says it all from for that Trump example. But I think what I find a little bit dangerous is when people believe that the skills that you use and you develop as a business person are easily transferable to government, for example. And you know, government po politics is everywhere, but it's, you know, politics is politics, and that takes a different set of skills. And you know, when you're in business, you have various stakeholders, usually shareholders being probably the most important. A lot of companies will say that their people are the most important, but let's face it, it's shareholders and investors. When you know you're in government or you're in elected office, it's your accountability is very different, and the people and those interests that you've got to keep on side respond to very, very different things to, for example, what shareholders would respond to. So, you know, understanding that, understanding how politics works, understanding how the media works, etc. These are very different skills. It's not that a good business person can't develop these skills, and some of them have and do in different countries. But I think, you know, we'd be in a better
Which
world if
examples roll
people.
off the tongue?
Well, I mean, you know, I think
I think that answers
it's
my point, right?
a.
Because businesses are set up to make money, and government's more than making money. It's about improving lives, creating long-term policy platforms for the direction of a country. Maybe a good business leader could have the strategic foresight of direction and so on, but ultimately they're there to make money. So I think they often struggle on divesting their own financial interests from the decision making when it comes to political judgment. They often run into problems on ethics. And I'm going to add that, which I think is a slight pitch of me. I'm going to say for you as well, Ozan, but people like lawyers and economists make much better politicians.
Look, I think you're absolutely right. I'm struggling to figure out a prominent or think of a prominent business leader who's become a prominent political leader. However, I can probably give you many examples of people that I've interacted with in my professional life who have become politicians, and not prominent ones, but elected members of parliament who've had a small business background or entrepreneurial background, and some of them in big businesses as well. So, you know, and I think that to me is important. I think, you know, when you've got elected office, when you've got a parliament, you need a big diversity of people. But the issue is, if you're a very high prominent business leader, you're not going to be you know, content with becoming a backbencher or a elected member of parliament who sits in the background. And that, I think that comes back to what I was talking about in terms of relevance deprivation. Like, you know, if you're a very high prominent business person, you're going to want to be at the front of the political kind of and lead, etc. Because otherwise, I don't think your ego would survive. So that to me is a difficult one, and I can't really think of anybody that has managed to do that all that successfully. But as I said, I think there are been plenty of people in parliaments doing good work within parliaments and passing good laws who have got a business background, and they bring, I think, a valuable kind of contribution to the parliament. So I think those are two very different things that you need to think about. I think, it's not I don't think it's clear cut. I think there is a role for people who have developed themselves and developed their skills in business and in the corporate world to play in the public office as well. But yeah, I haven't. You're absolutely right. You got me on that. I can't think of one that's a prominent political leader.
I'm just relieved that you didn't say Donald Trump, who obviously does come from a business background, is a prominent political leader, but has some questionable ethics and judgment. One of the best pieces of advice I ever got was from someone who was a political opponent, but when I was in an advisory role with the government minister and was due to run for election at the following set of elections, sort of relevant when, said to me, "Why on earth do you want to give up power for elected office?" And I do wonder whether that's a question a lot of these business people who fund politicians and political parties should ask themselves. They're in the position of power because they have financial, in their case, strings to pull. Why give that up to have to face the public and explain decisions which sometimes can be very unpopular? So that maybe is a good question that
Yeah.
people like Zuckerberg and Musk should ask themselves: why give up power for political office, unless they're driven to appear on the balcony at the White House with the Easter Bunny, and give one of the most inappropriate comments or press comments about the passing of the Pope of any world leader, which Trump again seems to have ticked off with some skill.
Before we get onto that, I do have one example for you, which is an interesting one. For example, Malcolm Turnbull, one of the former prime ministers of Australia, he came from a pretty high, prominent business role and made it all the way to the top and became Australian prime minister. And one could argue, or one could have differing views on whether he was a good prime minister. I think if you were in his party, you probably thought that he was in the wrong party and he wasn't conservative enough to be a conservative prime minister. But I mean, he was, compared to what we're witnessing now and the example that we have in front of us today, Malcolm Turnbull looks like he did a bloody amazing job. So that is one. And also, I think one of the things that you have to kind of keep in mind, there are plenty of examples who of people who've become politicians and at the same time become very successful business people. Berlusconi is one. So again, it's
Oh, that's a really bad example.
questionable ethics, obviously. So it's obviously they've built their business empire as they've gotten higher in their political life. So those are examples, I suppose, that you do have. But yes, you're right. It wasn't an example that I was giving to make a positive, let's say, my friend.
Well, at least he didn't get into trouble with the Panama Papers.
Well, Rodney, Ozan's going to spend the next week between now and the next podcast thinking about different business people all around the world who made successful politicians.
Fantastic. Berlusconi was a good one.
You'll get a list.
We gave him some really good homework. Rodney, you alluded to it earlier, but so obviously the passing of Pope Francis has indeed been one of the biggest stories of the week, and now cardinals from around the world will gather in the Sistine Chapel in early May to elect a new Pope following Pope Francis's death on Easter Monday. His funeral will be held on Saturday with many world leaders attending. And tell us what Donald Trump said about his plans to attend the funeral and his thoughts about it, rather.
He said he's got tickets and he's looking forward to it, which is a very odd thing to say about attending any funeral or memorial event, and certainly one that marks the passing of a very significant global figure. So yeah, I mean, 10 out of 10 for Trump, and once again, not exercising great judgment or skill as a world leader, and the contrast between his comments and that of Mark Carney, for example, only in his 51st state, are, I mean, it's just night and day. Carney gave a very carefully crafted statement that reflected the significant role that Pope Francis had played, as well as his own reference points and takeaways and leadership thoughts and so on. Yeah, it was a I'm gonna say classic Trump, behavior or misbehavior.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting to see if you look forward to funerals. Yeah, interesting comment. I don't know, Ozan, do you look forward to funerals?
Only if people you don't like. Sorry.
Well, yes. Fortunately, I haven't attended too many, and they're not a really big part of my life, fortunately, knock on wood. But no, I don't think if I was to attend a funeral of anybody, even somebody I didn't personally know, I'd not really an occasion I would look forward to. It wouldn't really be the best way to describe it. But as Rodney said, it's classic Trump, and it is again, he's trying to steal the limelight and the spotlight, as the world, mourns. Hundreds of millions, billions of Catholics around the world mourn the passing of Pope Francis, who, as Rodney said, was a very significant world leader, and one that I think many people would consider as trying to reform the Catholic Church and address head on some very difficult issues that the Catholic Church has faced over the years. Yeah, I think the choice of words were pretty poor, but hey, I mean, who am I to try and figure out what goes through his mind? So, but what is very interesting, and I think it's something that we should probably spend a bit of time about, is we should put simply how the next pope is selected and elected. And I know I'm excited by lists, which I'm going to provide you next week. But I'm also very excited about elections. It's starting to say a lot about my mental health and psychology. But I am extremely interested in elections, and I have to say the conclave that is about to take place, which is put simply the word for the gathering of all of the cardinals who can vote for the next pope, is a fascinating, fascinating thing to look into. So one of the things that there was an Oscar-nominated movie called The Conclave about 6 months ago, I think it came out. I'd encourage people to watch it. But it's certainly a very interesting way that it's got its roots in centuries of secrecy. And I suspect we touched on politics before, well, more than touched on politics on this podcast, but we talked about politics in government, and I suspect the politics in the Sistine Chapel is going to be very interesting when 135 cardinals who can vote are going to get together in about 2 weeks, and spend days voting on who the next pope should be. So. But I'm looking forward to seeing that process.
And it's a very secretive process, isn't it, Rodney? As I understand, there's no sort of communication with the outside world. It's a very, very traditional way of electing the new pope.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to talk about it, obviously, because I've got inside knowledge of how the conclave works. So on that basis, I'm not gonna share it with you on this podcast, Arden, but. The significant change this time is the number of cardinals that have been appointed by Pope Francis from the Global South, South America, and Africa, and what potential impact that may have. But I don't think anyone is really any the wiser in terms of the potential runners and riders for this. Although there is a like there's a media thing. I was in Manama in Bahrain in 2022 when the Pope visited, and there's a whole sort of media, papal media entourage that comes to these types of events, and they'll obviously be have some inside knowledge because they're receiving briefings from senior Vatican officials and so on, and there'll be a level of knowledge. But like the idea that the Daily Star, the Sun in the UK, tabloid papers could run some sort of who the favourites are and who the likelies are, with some odds against them is basically fanciful. This is a secretive process. The discussions will be secretive, and we're going to receive the outcome at some point in the next couple of weeks. But the only sort of intelligence point is the changed composition of the cardinal base who's going to attend the conclave and come to a decision on who's next in the role of head of the Catholic Church.
And one of the things that you touched on around, the kind of composition of the cardinals, etc. But, obviously there's a big kind of push on to keep Pope Francis's legacy and continue that in terms of addressing some of the issues that the Catholic Church has faced, etc. And, some of the interesting names have been kind of thrown around. I agree with you. I don't think that they're the problem. A lot of them are speculation, but one of the cardinals. I think he's the Archbishop of Manila, for example, from the Philippines. The Archbishop of I think well, I think one from Ghana. But this would be a very interesting thing, and obviously Manila or the Philippines being one of the most devout Catholic countries, and I believe actually the biggest. Here's some trivia for you. The biggest gathering of humans at any event was apparently during Pope Francis's visit to Manila in I think 2015, where they got 6 million, 7 million people on the streets, and that's obviously an estimate, but of course, nothing compared to Trump's inauguration crowds, obviously. But I think. It will be very interesting to see which direction the Catholic Church goes in. I think that will be for me, and they've all got to be aware of it. As you said, 108 of these 135 have been appointed by Pope Francis. So one would think that they go down that kind of or continue that path. But saying that, a large majority of the Europeans, I believe, are still kind of conservative. Cardinals, so they might, pick somebody. And I think one of the candidates from Hungary is also one of the contenders from Hungary is a more of a conservative cardinal. So it'd be very interesting to see. I think it's got, in a world where we are seriously lacking leadership, it will be interesting to see what type of profile the Catholic Church decides to kind of, or the cardinals decide to put up and, and provide some leadership to the world.
Well, there's another election happening in the next little while, and that is indeed in Canada on the 28th of April. But more than 7 million people have already cast their ballots over 4 days of advanced voting in the country's election. Canada, of course, is a country of a population of about 41 million people and around 29 million eligible voters. The Liberal leader, the relatively new Prime Minister, Mark Carney, is seen as the front runner. So, Rodney, is it his election to lose, do you think?
It was his opponent's election to lose a couple of months ago, and now it's all there for Carney to win. They're 5 points up in the polls. The Conservatives have dropped, fueled by Canadian nationalism in response to the 51st state nonsense from Trump and the US administration. And Carney's now on the cusp of an outright majority. The 43% figure should translate into 172 seats, which is what he needs for an overall majority. The other factor is that Quebec nationalism has dipped somewhat, and the Liberals, who are the left in Canada or centre left, are likely to make gains there as well. So Yeah, it's he has to win a seat himself, of course, because he doesn't hold a seat, nor did he hold one prior to the election, which is one of the oddities of the Canadian electoral system. But yeah, all good, quite exciting. It looks like populist right is going to not win in Canada, and boring as he is, Mark Carney seems like a steady Eddie for the good people of Canada who are a steady Eddie type bunch.
And speaking of economists who make good politicians, of course, Carney was, he previously led the central banks of Canada and Britain, and he believes that his global experience managing economic crises makes him the ideal candidate. So I guess in many ways, Ozan, someone well positioned to get Canada through the trade war.
Yeah,
Oh yeah, I
100%.
mean, look,
Go ahead, Ozan.
he's no, it's just, I mean, he's untested, obviously. He's not even in parliament. He's, you know, I'm not sure I 100% agree that economists make good politicians. I think, you know, as I said, you need a good kind of diverse range of backgrounds. I think, you know, economists certainly bring a bunch of skills in this day and age that are very much required, like understanding the fundamentals of how, you know, economic systems work. It's sad I even have to say that this is something that a leader should understand, but apparently it is. You know, he's obviously a very different leader and will be a different prime minister if he gets elected on the 28th of April to his predecessor, Justin Trudeau. I think, you know, until kind of the last 6 to 12 months of Justin Trudeau's term, you know, before that he was considered as quite a popular leader, charismatic, and you know, somebody who kind of pushed a whole bunch of reforms, etc. So I think for the times we're in, someone like Carney is exactly where probably you want to be. And you know, at the end of the day, he's, if you look at the polls, it's January 6th of this year. The Liberals were sitting at 20.1%, and the Conservatives were sitting on 44.2% in terms of the polls. And as Rodney mentioned, that's, you know, the Liberals are now up to 43.3% in the latest polls. Conservatives down to 38. You know, I think much of this has to do with obviously Trump. I would say 90-95%, but I think there's also an element of let's give him a go. I think Trudeau was becoming somewhat unpopular, so having a change of leadership at the time that they did, I think made a big difference in terms of the support, because I think fundamentally, you know, there wasn't a massive problem with some of the agenda, or most of the agenda that they had kind of followed, but I think Trudeau, it was time for him to go, obviously. So yeah, I think it's the right person for the right for the time, and you know, I think if you're the Conservatives in Canada, you know, you would have to be so annoyed at Trump. And you know, at the end of the day, it's Trump who has driven most of this, and his antics about the 51st state, his trade war, etc. And you know, the Canadians have said we're up for a fight, and elbows up, as they say in their terms. And they're leading the kind of resistance against Trump. So it's going to be a fascinating outcome. And I think many the thing that interests me most is what happens from here on in. Obviously, the Australian election's coming up, which we'll discuss in detail next week. But if you're a conservative in another country, you've got to be looking at this and saying, okay, this brand of politics just is not going to kind of work. And you know, I need to we need to look at something else. And you know, maybe we've gone beyond the whole, as we experienced last year. A lot of incumbents lost the election. People wanted change. You know, status quo wasn't satisfying people, etc. But maybe, you know, we're entering a period where people want stability, and maybe status quo is something that people might kind of swing back towards and support. So obviously that has ramifications for the Australian election coming up as well.
Yeah, look, there's another point to this, which is often at elections when you've had a party in power for a long time, and Trudeau have been in power since whenever, but successive terms and so on. The opposition, if things aren't going well economically, just say this is a disaster, it's time for a change, you need a change. And it's quite difficult for the incumbents to sell the fact that if you make that change, it will be a disaster because they don't have any direct experience of the change. Often it's quite easy for the electorate to say, well, it can't get any worse. What Trump's done is he's given those people on the right in these other countries the ability to say, this is the alternative. It's something like what Donald Trump's doing. It's chaos. It's a disaster. It's not good for our country. And therefore, it gives if you're in Canada or you're in Australia and you want to say this is a glimpse of what it would be like with the opposition in charge, populist right, whatever. MAGA is the example. Trump is the example. Perhaps you want to pass on that at this time. So I do wonder whether it's not just a nationalistic response to Trump's behavior towards Canada. It's also that little bit of foresight into what a similar type government might offer to those countries, and people are saying no thank you. If there's any prospect that's like that, it's a no thank you.
Absolutely. And I mean, you're seeing it in a number of elections, the Australian election as well, that people who only 3, 4 months ago were talking very much MAGA language and very Trumpian have now backed off and are doing everything they can to avoid being perceived as MAGA. And I think that's saying a lot, I think. Of course, it hasn't reflected in the US in terms of Trump support and MAGA support, but for the reasons I outlined earlier, I think that we're going to see that as well. I think a lot of the backlash against the MAGA way of doing things and Trump are going to slowly start to seep into the American kind of political discourse and opinion polls as well.
Can we just have one final point, sorry, of potential optimism for the Conservatives in Canada, because it just might be a matter of a few years. The other example I can think of when a charismatic, long-serving leader with lots of charm, communication skills, whose shine eventually wore off, was replaced by
Berlusconi,
someone with economic competence. Gordon Brown didn't last that long, so perhaps there's an
yeah.
opportunity for the Conservatives to nip in again in a couple of years a Carney leadership, because maybe he just doesn't have that ability to communicate in the same way that his predecessor did. But let's see. It would
Very
require
good
the
point. Very good
Conservatives to
point.
find a David Cameron type for that to happen. They might not want to do that.
Well, a good preview to next week's podcast. We'll go through the results of the Canadian election. We'll also preview the Australian and Singapore elections, which are happening on Saturday, May 3rd. But before we go this week, Rodney, take us through this historic ruling in the UK where the highest court ruled that the legal definition of a woman is based on biological sex and that transgender women do not fall within that legal definition under equality law. How did it get to the highest court, and what are the ramifications of this ruling?
So, I mean, this is interesting because, I mean, all legal rulings that run to 90 odd pages are interesting. I'm sure if you've got an hour to spare and you read reasonably quickly, you can have a look at it yourself, and you can find that it's wonderfully set out in terms of what information they've taken into account, how they've applied that, and so on. So there's a wonderful structure to these things. But this particular case came from a challenge to Scottish government ministers who issued guidance, successive elements of guidance. They were challenged by a campaigning group for women's rights. The political context in Scotland is going back to 2022, when the Scottish National Party at that time got themselves very on I'm going to say a trans hook. It became a very important part of what they saw as their campaigning, and I think maybe the estimate was something like 20,000 registered trans people within the population or something. So it's a small number of people, but clearly, in an effort to expand their base, they were looking at wedge issues where they could attack the Conservatives in Scotland and potentially Labour as well. The Scottish government was attempting to be incredibly progressive, and this guidance was issued, and the guidance was about the positive discrimination or the promotion of or encouragement of appointment of women to public appointed boards. That might be like a local non-government agency or something where there's a board, and accelerate gender balance within that. And within that guidance, the Scottish government ministers reference the Equality Act 2010, which is Westminster, not devolved, but central government legislation. And they said for the purposes of that act, the definition of a woman also includes trans male to female trans. Okay, so the desire was to include trans women within the definition of women for the purposes of equality appointees to a board. So if there was a vacancy and it was four, five men already there, four women, and the agenda would be to find either a biological female or a trans female to fill the additional slot to create balance. And of course, if you reject the concept of non-biological females being the intended promoted group, you end up with the point where actually you end up with six men and four women if you make that argument on the basis of biology. Anyway, so that's part of the thinking behind the campaigning group who made the challenge. It turned out that because the Equality Act was Westminster legislation, that the Scottish government couldn't define it. So there's three categories of these things within devolved government in the UK constitution. Put simply, I'm going to say, there's devolved matters which rest with either the governments or parliaments or assemblies in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. There's reserved matters which are retained by Westminster but capable of devolution, and then there are accepted matters like defence and foreign affairs and so on, which can never be given to the regional assemblies or parliaments. This falls into the reserve category in terms of this definition. And what the Supreme Court, which is now the current senior court in the UK, replacing the House of Lords a number of years ago, as the lead court, said that within the Equality Act, the definition of a woman is biological only. Now, the key point here as well is the Equality Act also protects several categories of people from discrimination, which includes trans, based on gender, age, da-da-da-da, sexual orientation. There's a whole list of things. So it's not that trans persons aren't protected from discrimination in the UK. It's simply for the purposes of this particular thing under the Equality Act. If you want to use what the definition of woman is in the Equality Act, it relates to female only. But it sort of exploded into this broader culture wars type argument in the UK that the legal definition of women for now and evermore is biological only. And that's not really the right way to interpret this particular case. It's also not right to think that you can't that you can discriminate against people based on them being trans rather than biological, whatever, because again, that's not the case. This is simply about the promotion in Scotland of women to level out the male female appointees to boards and sort of what bites in relation to that. And they had a second bite at this, which is where the Scottish ministers revised their guidance to deal with those who had got a gender recognition certificate, which is a component of the broader trans community in the UK who have some certification under the Gender Recognition Act 2004, that they have certification as a trans woman, if they're moving from male to female, or trans man, in terms of the opposite move. But again, that didn't cut any ice. That was the second challenge under this, which is the one that was reported last week. But I think there's small numbers of people who are trans within the UK. The level of politicization of anything that references trans people is pretty extreme pretty quickly. This related to board appointments and where a trans individual should sit within this, leveling out of appointees to public boards in Scotland. But more common is around public toilets, sport, and all the other, small issues within small issues, elements of the political discourse around the rights of trans people and so on. And it's all just there to load emotion, to toxify the debate and so on. But yeah, I mean, this was seen as a celebration for feminists in the UK who, I'm going to say, don't like the idea of trans persons encroaching onto their female space, as well as those on the right who see this as sort of some sort of woke culture wars type thing, which is an odd alliance in itself in the UK, where you can get the sort of the populist right and the feminist left coming together to celebrate a victory about something which was probably a little more nuanced than either of them cared to acknowledge. But I hope that's helpful, put simply, of course.
It's obviously a complicated topic, but one question I have is, these kind of things obviously go to court when the court needs to interpret what Parliament meant when it enacted a certain legislation and tried to define something. So obviously the court's role here, and I'm going to ask you to put your lawyer hat on here, Rodney, but the court's role is to interpret what Parliament said. So the question is then, why did it need to get to this? Why did it need to get to the highest court? Parliament and politicians could have easily stepped in and, redefined that particular part of that particular legislation, etc. Is it a case that it's a debate that politicians didn't want to get involved in?
I think it's a debate that politicians, to an extent, engineered. What it was, rather than it was a judicial review on the lawfulness of guidance issued by Scottish government ministers, who they didn't want to concede that they'd done something unlawful, which is part of it. But also, given the SNP's role in Scotland, which is the Scottish Nationalist Party campaigning for independence in the Scottish government, it was an opportunity to create some friction between them and the UK government. And as much as I'm sure that they had the welfare of trans people in mind, in some part of the consideration, I'm also pretty confident that they had friction with the UK Conservative government as it was at that time, because it was before the Starmer Labour government. That was part of their calculation to create that type of friction, where the Conservatives would be seen as taking something off the Scottish government, removing their right to decide for themselves, etc., because they didn't have to issue this guidance related to Westminster legislation, in my view, and they could have looked to promote equality across board participation in a different way. That might have created a third category, for all I know, that reflects a broader population, but they didn't choose to do that. And the fact that they didn't choose to do that suggests an element of seeking a fight. And who would have thought it, that I could say that there was a Scotsman or a Scotswoman seeking a fight with the English? I think that's what it really comes down to as well.
Well, a good point to end on. Obviously, a complicated matter, and thank you, Rodney, for putting it as simply as you possibly could. Gents, a big week this week. Looking forward to discussing elections. And, well, I'm going to take a guess that Donald Trump will feature in next week's podcast as well. But until then, appreciate your time this week. See you next.
Thanks,
Cheers.
Adam.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch. Thanks for listening.